my God. I haven't been in here for years.
Hey! Are you listening to me?
Yes, I am! I think you're having a nervous breakdown.
Welcome to Aspect Radio. I'm Corey Kraft.
And I'm Ben Flanagan. Corey, we have so much to discuss on this episode, including Wes Anderson's new film, Moonrise Kingdom, which my brother saw in Paris, France. Tons of new trailers and images, including the latest from Tarantino, Paul Thomas Anderson, and James Bond. Plus, whether the success of The Avengers is a bad thing for Hollywood. But first, Corey, we thought we were getting a G.I. Joe sequel in June, but apparently not.
On my orders, the G.I. Joes were terminated with extreme prejudice.
They're all dead.
We were set up right from the start.
We're all that's left.
Paramount Pictures recently announced the release has been delayed until March 29, 2013, citing their preference to carefully convert it to 3D, as well as add more Channing Tatum with reshoots. But now there's some speculation that they may just have a crappy movie on their hands. What story are you buying?
Well, last week when this was announced, the delay of this movie, you know, when you consider how much the studio had already spent on marketing, you know, they paid for a Super Bowl spot in January. They've had two trailers play in movie theaters for most of the year, posters all over the place, standees in movie theaters, even things like toys already hitting some stores. To delay a movie a month before its release was extremely fishy. And converting it to 3D, the party line was so that the film could maximize its grosses overseas, because as we've seen for years, overseas 3D is incredibly popular. Not that it isn't here, but those movies do have a pronounced 3D bump in overseas markets. But that's been known. That's something that the studio knew even long before G.I. Joe Retaliation went into production. So that seemed extremely fishy to me, the idea that that would be the reason to sort of waste a marketing campaign and restart it at the beginning of next year. As far as reshoots, adding more Channing Tatum, with the success that he's had as an actor already this year, I believe that part of it, but I would think that the reshoots would probably be more extensive than just that. The rumors, and I don't think this is a spoiler because apparently it's not going to be true anymore, but the rumors, and this was pretty easy to guess from the trailers that we saw of this movie, were that Channing Tatum's character Duke would be killed near the beginning of the movie, with the rest of the G.I. Joe crew leaving only the four or five heroes that are in the movie for the majority of the trailer, I guess, to sort of fight Cobra or whatever. But understandably, I guess, with his growing popularity, they saw that as a waste. But rumor is also that the buzz around this movie has been bad in its test screenings, so I'm sure that they want to fix that. Of course, for them to delay a bad movie, I mean, Hollywood releases tons of bad movies every summer. For them to delay a bad movie for 9 months indicates to me that it was probably a very, very bad movie, potentially a franchise-killing movie, and probably has a lot to do with Hasbro not wanting to go back to their stockholders after the catastrophic failure of Battleship and then subsequently a very unpopular G.I. Joe sequel.
The only thing I buy in this whole thing is the Channing Tatum angle.
Yeah.
And because his star continues to rise to A-list status, and he's having a big year, big past couple of years, and despite my feelings or your feelings about him as an actor overall, he is a box office draw at this point, and G.I. Joe 2 would have benefited greatly from more of a Channing Tatum presence. And I do believe that adding him is going to take extensive reshoots, because they're talking about fusing him even more so into the story, and I'm guessing he probably dips out in the first 15 to 20 minutes of the movie.
That's the impression that I got
right
from the trailers.
If you're adding more screen time for him, that's going to take a lot, especially rewrites, and you're going to have to make him a larger part character-wise.
Well, here's the interesting thing. You know, if the thing was just that Duke died in the beginning of the movie, or all the G.I. Joes died or whatever, why not just film a quick scene with him waking up in a hospital somewhere or something, you know, for the end of the movie, or add him to the third act? Just the fact that they are so radically apparently retooling the movie is a huge question mark, particularly the average moviegoer might not be privy to the idea that this movie was delayed. And so when it is released finally in March, after them having seen trailers for it and for the entire first half of 2012, I imagine that's going to be pretty confusing for a lot of people. So, I mean, either the movie's terrible or they're essentially remaking it. I don't know which.
I don't understand it either. I don't get it, because the trailer we got for G.I. Joe Retaliation, to me, suggested a better movie than the first movie. I'm not a big fan, and a lot of people aren't. You are a rare exception.
Yeah, I do like that movie.
In the case of the people who liked that movie.
Uh-huh.
I think it was bad. But I was excited about this new film and thought, hey, I would see that in the theater. It looks exciting. And I'm glad they're replacing Channing Tatum with someone like The Rock, who I think is a more dynamic action screen presence.
Mm-hmm.
Where I find it very suspicious is studios, like you said, do enough research ahead of time to know whether or not 3D is going to benefit them. And I honestly think, I don't understand why studios don't go ahead and have 3D retrofit anyway as a contingency plan if their tracking isn't very good. So you have 3D to release just in case. It just seems like it might be worth the cost, because I know it's not terribly expensive for these studios to retrofit these movies in 3D. So why not just have it on hand just in case? Now, like you said, spending millions of dollars on the Super Bowl ad, the toys, and basically just throwing that under the rug.
Throwing the entire marketing campaign out.
Until March. That makes no sense to me.
No, it
doesn't.
Because
this movie wasn't going up against a lot in late June. It had a week to have a big splash and do fairly well until another big release that escapes me right now was going to come in.
Spider-Man,
exactly, which is going to succeed. And it would
probably
knock whatever out of the water. I mean, it's Spider-Man, and Sony knows how to market that product. It's going up against The Host the weekend it's set to be released. I think that's the adaptation of the Stephanie Meyer novel. And springtime usually gives these big studio tentpole releases way less competition and more room to succeed out of the summertime anyway. So it makes sense in some ways, but like you said, this is one huge question mark. I don't understand why you delay an entire movie nearly a year. It makes no sense to me.
Well, do you think that this movie is going to finally be released with this taint of failure or perceived failure when it finally does come out? I mean, not only with people like you and me who are conscious of the studio politics that might have led to it, but also just people who will see it come out and think, hey, didn't that come out last summer? I thought that I just missed that. You know, is this actually going to be benefited by such a radical shift in release date, do you think?
I don't know. And my question is, how obvious are the changes going to be? Is it going to look rushed? Are these changes going to be so obvious to where it looks nothing like the trailer that we've already seen, which again looked like a decent enough movie? Another thing I don't understand is, I think they could have released the movie as scheduled even with less Channing Tatum, because number one, he's in the movie. So you have his face that you can plaster all over your marketing. You can put as much as you possibly can of him in TV spots and trailers and other items that have anything to do with this movie, and put his name above the credits. He has his own teaser poster,
right?
But he's not even on like the main one sheet of the film.
Because I bet he's only in the first 10 minutes.
That shouldn't matter.
Right.
It really shouldn't at this point. It's almost like, you remember, you know those movies that big stars like, say, Jim Carrey or Adam Sandler or like Jean-Claude Van Damme even, you go back retroactively and find out about these small movies they were in, and
yeah,
they're re-released on DVD and video, and even if they have a 5-minute part, their face is right at the center of the poster or the box that
right.
it's released on. Apply that to G.I. Joe Retaliation.
Well, it's not like The Rock and Bruce Willis aren't marketable stars. I mean, I think this boils down foremost to Hasbro not wanting to get clobbered by stockholders after G.I. Joe comes out and makes $40 million opening weekend, is respectable, but then drops off like 70%. One, for being a bad movie, which by all accounts from test screenings it is, and two, just because Spider-Man is coming out, it's going to get clobbered that next week. So if Hasbro has to go back and justify their foray into movie making after two very high profile failures really close to one another, you know, that's probably bad business. And I bet that played a lot into it. I don't buy the fact that Paramount wants to make this movie better because they're now committed to making good movies for some reason.
When has that ever stopped a studio?
Right.
So I think that this is one of the biggest question marks in movie marketing history.
Well, this is unprecedented. You don't have a studio tentpole summer release pulled from the release schedule a month before it comes out in the swing of its marketing campaign. This just has never happened before. And it could pay off, or it could just be, you know, a loss moved from one calendar year to the next for Paramount and Hasbro.
And as an audience member, honestly, I say go ahead and release whatever you had, because it can't be as bad as the first one that you released.
I think it could be a lot worse, but
it would take a lot, in my opinion.
It wouldn't take all that much.
I think it's more a matter of a reaction to Battleship and the fact that it's right after it was going to release so quickly after that. It's the only thing that makes sense.
Yeah.
For them just to completely and dramatically change everything.
I think so.
And that it was probably a bad movie.
Yeah. And I mean, we'll talk about this a little later, but I think that audiences who are going to see these summer movies are a lot more conscious of bad movies right now. And, you know, when we get to that topic, I'll bring that up again. But
my name is Peter Weyland. And if you'll indulge me, I'd like to change the world.
War, poverty, cruelty, unnecessary violence. I understand human emotions, although I do not feel them myself. This allows me to be more efficient and capable, and makes it easier for my human counterparts to interact with me.
Is there anything you would like to say, David?
I would like to express gratitude to those who created me.
Well, to move on, Ben, movie marketing, as we were just talking about, is out of control. We always complain that we see too much in trailers these days, yet we subject ourselves to every spoiler by clicking on whatever Hollywood or websites throw at us. We get 6-minute trailers for tentpole releases, like the 6-minute trailer of The Amazing Spider-Man attached to the IMAX showings of Men in Black 3. We get countless still images, set photos, TV spots, not to mention the viral marketing campaigns for movies like Prometheus, The Dark Knight Rises, and The Amazing Spider-Man. So how much is too much, or is it not even enough?
Well, what we're getting is too much. I think that some of these studios get out of control with their viral marketing, and I think that they get way too cute, especially in the case of Prometheus, which I think is starting to show a lot of insecurity in its marketing by releasing as much as it is at this point.
I agree.
This is a project that should be shrouded in secrecy. It should take a note from somebody like Christopher Nolan, who has successfully kept so much of his films under wraps and refuses to give you even a shred of what he wants you to experience purely and as a whole when the film finally comes out. And you can make the exception with this 8-minute prologue that he released, which was just honestly a very tiny taste of what we might be in store for later in July. But it just honestly makes no sense that week after week or month after month, 20th Century Fox is going to throw another fake ad down our throats here with either this Guy Pearce TED talk that he gives or this commercial featuring this android played by Michael Fassbender. It's just enough.
Those were the first two, like, mysterious bits of promotion, and those were cool. But it seems like we've had a featurette about the making of the movie an interview with the actors every day.
Or another trailer.
Yeah.
Another trailer. Why do we need more? Why do you want to show us so much more? And honestly, I'm a little more okay with seeing more of the film in these trailers than I am with these phony promotional videos like the TED Talk and like the Android
commercial. But see, those don't reveal anything. And,
right,
and that's fun. That's just peripheral sort of cute little marketing stuff. I mean, it doesn't add anything, but it doesn't really ruin the mystery of the film. But I think that insecurity in the part of Prometheus and The Amazing Spider-Man is right on. I think that Prometheus being an R-rated sci-fi tentpole release that's very expensive, Fox wants to protect their investment. They want to make sure that people are comfortable with the premise. They don't think it's too weird. You know, they're familiar enough with it going in so that they can stand to recoup a lot of that money. Because while the initial trailers and the initial marketing hooked people like me in, it's going to take a little bit more of a specialized approach to hook in your average moviegoer.
It's almost too late for that, though.
Well, they're trying.
This film is coming out next week.
They're certainly giving it their all.
I have a little bone to pick with you guys on this.
Okay.
I think you're both really out of touch with reality when it comes to marketing on movies. I have seen the Prometheus trailer twice, and that's all I've seen of Prometheus.
Okay.
And I see a lot of movies, not nearly as many as you guys, but I don't go to any sites that have any sort of movie promotional bits. Like, I haven't seen any of this. I've seen the trailer for The Dark Knight Rises twice. The fact is that the reason that there's so much marketing out there is because people are so segregated now in the way that they consume content that the people like us who tend to consume a lot more content see it in a lot of different places. But those who just watch TV, and that's about all they really do when it comes to media, they're just seeing those TV spots, and that's it.
Well, then I don't know how to explain you. To me, that it seems like you're more out of touch with how movies are marketed, because these movies, in my opinion, and yeah, I look for it more than most consumers, I feel like it's been shoved down my throat. And the fact that you consume as much as you do, you produce a movie podcast and maybe only watch TV, and you've only seen those few trailers or not much of Prometheus at all, that confuses me, because, I mean, tell me I'm crazy, Corey, but I just feel like we are oversaturated with these movies so far.
Well, I've avoided the Prometheus featurettes that have been released in the last couple weeks. I just chose not to watch them. I saw that they were out, and I was like, yeah, okay, they're really pushing that hard.
Like you guys mentioned still photos. Where do you see those?
Well, the movie websites.
All right. Magazines. TED Talk, where do you see that?
That was released just, I don't know where it was released. It was just a little viral clip that was released online.
Whose audience are we talking about here, though? We're talking about Prometheus's audience. We're not talking about people who inexplicably are watching the NBA Finals or the NBA playoffs,
but that's
and
they...
suddenly there's a tie-in promotion where Stephen A. Smith, an obscure enough basketball analyst who was cut during dress rehearsal on Saturday Night Live recently, probably because not enough people knew who he was when Jay Farrow was doing an impression. They've got Stephen A. Smith hawking Prometheus to people who are watching basketball.
I don't disagree that they seem a little desperate. However,
well, it's not
they're trying to reach. Well, you
they're,
know
they're
what
trying
I mean.
To reach. They're trying to reach the maximum audience possible, because this isn't like a Christopher Nolan film that does have a built-in audience and that can get away with the mystery. They just want to maximize.
They want it to be a blockbuster like Dark Knight Rises.
Exactly.
It won't be, but that's what they want. That is their goal.
Here's the problem. And I respect the fact that they're shying away from the fact that this is an Alien prequel, but had they gone with that angle in the marketing, I think it would have done much better, because you do have the built-in audience of people who know what Alien is and love it, and there are people out there who are buying those DVDs right now and buying those Blu-rays and who would be really excited to know for a fact that they're about to see a movie that is officially connected to the Alien universe that Ridley Scott launched back in 1979.
I mean, I understand the reluctance to do that, though, because then you've had three high-profile Alien-related flops in a row, if not four. I don't know how well Alien 3 did back in 1991 or whatever. And from all accounts, Prometheus has a lot more going for it and is concerned with more than just being a straight Alien prequel. Maybe that's something they could have played up a little more, though. I don't know. We'll see how the marketing pays off when the movie's released. But as far as being oversaturated, you know, Andrew, I think you do make a good point, because, of course, I'm oversaturated with it. But, you know, I don't get timidity from Fox regarding Prometheus. I get wanting to maximize their profit. With The Amazing Spider-Man, I get fear. I feel like the buzz for Spider-Man is tepid at best amongst not only fans of that franchise, but the general public, who are thinking things like, we saw that movie already, what are you doing? So they're going to be pushing that movie hard. You think you're oversaturated with Prometheus now? You wait for a couple weeks for Spider-Man for the full marketing push to kick in there.
Because
they're getting a $70 million opening weekend, come hell or high water. You won't be able to go anywhere without seeing a picture of Spider-Man. I mean, putting 6 minutes of a movie in front of Men in Black 3, it's a cool way, I guess, to show, like, the... You see, I don't even know what that showed. Because I saw Men in Black 3. I saw the 6 minutes. It shows some of the action. It shows a scene with Gwen Stacy and Peter Parker. It shows Martin Sheen, finally, as Uncle Ben. And it shows the goofy-ass lizard villain a little bit more clearly, along with how the 3D is going to look. It was not impressive. And the fact that that's their sizzle reel, it frightens me a little bit with that movie. But I think that because this movie is being so coolly received so far, you're going to see a lot more Spider-Man promotion than we already have.
And I think that's what makes it feel desperate. Look right. at the Avengers. That had way more marketing than either of these have had. And yes, you expected more of it, but my Dr. Pepper cans had Avengers on it, you know, yeah. every day, and I was getting a different Avenger. And I actually thought it was kind of cool, but I think part of that is because you were excited about the movie.
You were interested.
You were interested 100%, no reservations at all. Whereas I think that Prometheus to a lesser extent, but Amazing Spider-Man to a greater extent, it feels desperate and it feels timid because they're not confident in the movie.
They're saying, please come
see
it.
Or they're at least not confident in our reactions to what they're showing us so far.
My issue with Prometheus specifically has nothing to do with their desire to push it towards a broader audience. It has everything to do with the fact that we are that movie's audience, and how much are they willing to show us, and how much are they wanting to shove down our throats, because that obviously is all geared towards the people who are going to see Prometheus. The fact that they are releasing the TED Talk stuff and the Android commercial, that's for us.
But you're going to see it anyway, right? No matter how much they market it.
Not necessarily.
So they're really going to overmarket to you, and that's why you're not going to go see it, because you've seen too much in marketing?
No, because because I'm seeing so much more of it that it's showing me a film that doesn't look as good to me as it did the first time I saw the first couple of trailers. They're revealing way too much. And again, the fact that these geeks out here are so excited about this movie, I don't understand it. I did at the onset the fact that Ridley Scott is making his first science fiction movie since Blade Runner and Alien, two masterpieces in the genre. Do we dismiss the screenwriting credit for this movie?
So this is not marketing. This is your personal hesitation.
I've kind of moved on to another thing. But and good for them for not saying from the writer of the failure of a Lost finale that you hate, geeks, and from the writer of a science fiction film that none of you saw anyway probably hated when you saw it, The Darkest Hour. So what makes you so excited? A director has to have a good script, or at least a decent one to elevate. And early buzz around this movie is, from the folks that have seen it, is it's aight.
Hey, let's see it for ourselves. I'm not ready to dismiss it offhand. This is one of the movies that I've been most anticipating this year because it looks really great. So let me go into it, and if the screenplay sucks, if they weren't able to elevate it, the screenplay sucks. So be it. Let's deal with that then. But, I mean, as far as marketing goes, I've seen what I want to see. I know I'm going to see it. That's it.
But you need to watch this other featurette that we have.
I'm not going
to. Don't.
Just in case.
Don't do it, Ben. Well, don't do it.
I haven't watched any of the featurettes. Okay. I haven't watched any of them.
So is that why you're bothered? Because you've been shown all this stuff, but you don't want to look at it? So you're like, oh, man, I kind of want to look at all this stuff, but I don't want to spoil anything for myself. So
sometimes
stop showing it to me.
Well, like I said, we can't help but click. In the case of The Dark Knight Rises, which I think is doing a better job than Prometheus.
They haven't shown anything.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know anything about that movie.
See, with the trailers that they're showing, to me, they're all very good trailers.
Yeah.
And I've watched them over and over. And it seems like they're sort of strategically releasing these TV spots that aren't showing much new footage day after day. I feel like Deadline releases another TV spot. And so I think it's doing a much better job of keeping it a little closer to the vest.
It's a brazen costume for a cat burglar.
Yeah? Who are you pretending to be?
These are violent criminals that terrorize Gotham.
Bane. Born and raised in hell on earth.
I don't know. I see a good movie in there. And I don't see it right now with Prometheus.
See, I don't get that. I know that you have your own reasons not to see a good movie in Prometheus. The screenwriters, the fact that Ridley Scott hasn't really done anything of note since Kingdom of Heaven, if not before
that. I don't know
that.
If I count Kingdom of Heaven
well,
either.
See,
we're talking...
Okay, but you have your own agenda here as in regards to the screenplay, in regards to the director. You know, that's fine. I'm a little bit more optimistic.
It's not an agenda when you're talking about track record of these people who are involved. I love some of the things Ridley Scott has done, especially 30 years ago. I love the cast. I think it's a top-notch cast, although I don't understand why Idris Elba has a southern accent. But don't like the writers, and I'm skeptical about Ridley Scott's last five movies. If you just offer those up as where he stands as a director right now and whether or not he finds a renewed energy with this movie, that remains to be seen.
Well, I'm sure we'll talk about it.
Yeah.
I actually agree with you on all of those counts, Ben. There's not a person involved in the movie. Well, there's the people involved in that movie aren't the sort of people who are making me jump up and down to see it.
nonsense.
I'll be shocked if this hard R, obscure, poorly titled, marketing-wise, sci-fi movie cracks $80 million domestically at the box office. They should be happy with that if they even get that.
Wow.
I have a bad feeling about this movie's box office chances.
Prometheus and child actors.
You married a very bright guy. I got 150, 160 IQ.
You're figuring it in euros. In dollars, it's much less.
Corey, let's move on to a trend that's driving me absolutely insane.
Another one?
Yes. We've talked about studio marketing ad nauseum today and on previous episodes, but this needs to be addressed, in my opinion. When studios decide that they better change a film's title, you know something is up. I think so anyway. Either they're staying sensitive to current events, in the case of The Watch, formerly Neighborhood Watch, or they want to avoid negative connotations with other box office failures, like the case with John Carter of Mars, maybe having something to do with Mars Needs Moms, right, which is one of the all-time failures in the history of film, as is John Carter of Mars now, or John Carter. But sometimes it seems like these changes are not for the better, in John Carter's case. Paramount recently changed the title from Christopher McQuarrie's new film One Shot, starring Tom Cruise, simply to the title character's name, Jack Reacher, putting it squarely in the same bland first and last name category as John Carter, Larry Crown, and Michael Clayton.
Oh, don't throw Michael Clayton in there. It's a good movie.
These are all money moves, sure, and they think it's the right call from a financial standpoint, but I can't help but feel like the studios are shooting themselves in the foot when it comes to some of these title changes. What about you?
Well, it's like they expect that Jack Reacher is a character who I believe is the main character of a series of books. I don't remember the author's name at this point. Lee Child, maybe? Is that right? I don't know. Yeah, well, I think that speaks volumes. Jack Reacher is not a marketable name. You know, you could get away with, at this point anyway, like making a movie called Jack Sparrow, because that character has a built-in audience. People go see the movies that character is in for that character.
Or Rocky Balboa.
Rocky Balboa. Yeah, that's a good one. Rambo. You know, these characters are known, and Jack Reacher is not. It's like they assume that this is going to be a franchise before the first movie is even released, and that franchise, due to the strength of that movie, is going to be identified as the Jack Reacher movies or something like that. You know what I mean? So why not just call the first movie Jack Reacher? It doesn't make any sense. Plus, Jack Reacher, I mean, like you said, it is a bland title. These name titles are pretty bland titles, though I couldn't tell you what on earth you could name Larry Crown or Michael Clayton that would be more effective, though one of them is pretty awful, as it is anyway.
Well, it's these first and last name titles drive me absolutely bonkers. I mean, are we going to get a new Batman movie called Bruce Wayne? I mean, is there going to be a new James Bond movie called James Bond? Is there going to be a Jason Bourne titled movie? This is ridiculous. It's horribly bland. But at least, again, like you said, those are identifiable names. Right. Those are existing properties that have success. So those would at least make more sense than Jack Reacher. I've never heard of it.
Plus the crass jokes just write themselves.
Yeah, and you could name the movie the author's name, and I wouldn't know what the hell it was.
Right.
But let's look at some of these movies in recent years or in the past year, films that are coming out that have changed their title suddenly. This movie from Andrew Dominik, which you're greatly anticipating. This is the follow-up to one of your favorite films in the last decade.
That's right.
This is a movie called Killing Them Softly Now, which was previously called, within the last couple of months, Kogan's Trade.
Yeah, that's weird. Apparently, Killing Them Softly comes not from, you know, a Roberta Flack song, but from a line of dialogue in the film.
But is that what... And they've already released the clip now that features the line of dialogue.
Right. Going back to that other gripe of yours.
But are people going to assume, well, that must be a line of dialogue in the movie? Are they going to assume, well, that sounds like the Fugees biopic?
You ever killed anyone?
No.
You can get touchy-feely.
Touchy-feely.
Emotional, not fun. A lot of fuss. They cry, they plead, they beg, they piss themselves, they call for their mothers. It gets embarrassing. I like to kill them softly. From a distance. Not close enough for feelings. Don't like feelings. Don't want to think about them.
I mean, Kogan's Trade is a cool title. It's got this noir pulp fiction 70s style feel to it, but that one didn't offend me as much as some of the others. Like, one that's not on the list here, the changing of John Hillcoat's upcoming movie, Lawless. It was originally called The Wettest County in the World, which is really a really evocative title of Depression-era gangster business, and then Lawless just sounds like anything that you could possibly title a movie. That one I have an issue with. This one not so much, because at least it still sort of has something to do with the movie.
Yeah,
and it's still somewhat evocative.
And Terrence Malick had a film that he was making, which he was going to call Lawless, right?
Right, and I don't think he's going... But I mean, he changes his titles like 20 times
before. Well, see, that anyway. To me, that title change has at least done one good thing, and you know, it's forcing Terrence Malick to change the blandly titled movie that he had before to something else.
Right.
Unfortunately, like you said, this Lawless title exists for this movie. Now, Kogan's Trade wasn't going to make any money anyway, okay? And I don't know if this new title is going to make any sort of difference. I hope it's Andrew Dominik's choice, because if not, I don't get it. I don't understand, because it wasn't going to change its receipts that it was going to get.
Hey, you never know. Maybe they'll market it well. I mean, word out of Cannes is that it's a bit more accessible than The Assassination of Jesse James, though most movies are a bit more accessible than that movie. So they put a good marketing push behind it. You never know.
Here are two that make sense to me, okay? Although I don't agree with them necessarily, just from a personal standpoint. Woody Allen's film, which was previously called Bop Decameron and then was then called Nero Fiddle, two titles I actually like and prefer to its new title, which is To Rome with Love, which is a very marketable title. And it throws at the forefront where this movie takes place, just like Midnight in Paris did. So, yeah.
Riding the coattails of that financial success.
Okay, that makes sense. It makes sense. I prefer the old title. Ridley Scott, to bring him back up, his movie Robin Hood, which came out a couple of years ago, it was called Robin Hood. We all know Robin Hood. Why do we need another Robin Hood movie? If you've got a sort of like revisionist take on this story, why not name it something else? Mm-hmm. Something like Nottingham, which is interesting to me.
Well, the thing about that is the title of that movie changed to Robin Hood when early in the development process, when the entire focus of the movie changed. It was originally supposed to be quite revisionist, focusing on the Sheriff of Nottingham, who in Ridley Scott's eventual film played a very small role. The Sheriff of Nottingham was supposed to be like the hero figure in this movie, with Robin Hood being more of a villainous take on that character. So when the movie became more traditional and therefore really bland and boring, the title changed. But you're right. I mean, there are just all sorts of problems with that movie. That movie was just a misguided attempt from the get-go.
There's another title that we have here. We saw and really liked the movie Rise of the Planet of the Apes, which is a mouthful of a title and bad in my opinion, although the movie was very successful. I think mainly because it was a very good movie and would have succeeded despite the title. All you really need in there is apes, and people are going to know exactly what it is. Just call the next movie
Apes.
But I've read that previous titles of the project were Rise of the Apes, and then you had just Caesar. And I don't know how Caesar would have done, especially since you're sort of branching away from the property that you're rebooting, essentially. So they might have made the right decision, but again, it's just a mouthful of a title.
Well, today they announced the title of the sequel to be released on Memorial Day 2014, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
Why not just Dawn of the Apes?
Because it's the dawn of the Planet of the Apes. The apes have already had their dawn in Rise of the Planet of the Apes. This is the dawn of their control of the
also,
planet.
They were apes before they became smart. And
that's right. They were still apes.
Yeah.
They were always apes.
Well, what's the difference between the dawn and the rise of these apes?
Well, this is the dawn of the planet.
Oh, the dawn of the planet.
Dawn of the planet.
So what's the difference between the rise of the Planet of the Apes and the dawn of the Planet of the Apes?
Well, we've already established that probably should have just been called Rise of the Apes.
Okay.
Or apes. Leading into Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
God, okay.
It doesn't matter. They're good. It was a good movie.
Another movie I can think of is The Dark Knight Rises. And that's one that I think would have been much more interesting as maybe like Batman, Gotham City. Or
just Gotham.
Or just Gotham would
or
have
Gotham
been great.
City.
Yeah.
Or exactly, hey, why don't we wait and find out what the movie's about before we pass judgment on the title? Because we don't even know what it's about. He could rise at some point. You never know.
I'll agree with that. But if they had called the first movie, instead of Batman Begins, they'd put Dark Knight in the title or something. And then the second movie had also had Dark Knight. And I would see more point in putting it in the third one. But it just seems like they're trying to force The Dark Knight, those words, into this title way too hard.
Yeah. I mean, the previous movie, The Dark Knight, was the biggest success of the franchise history. It's one of the most successful movies domestically of all time. Yep. So, yeah, they want to evoke that.
But, okay. But That movie succeeded despite not having the word Batman in the title, and this is a Batman movie. So that was a risk on its own.
Yeah, I agree.
People are going to go see Batman, especially now that there has been The Dark Knight, and people will know that it is a sequel to The Dark Knight. Rises is the worst cliche in movie titling there is right now, and the fact that Christopher Nolan, one of our best modern filmmakers, has succumbed to that, to naming his movie something with rises in it, it makes no sense to
me. I would go see this movie if it were called The Adventures of Lucius Fox.
But that's the whole point.
Who gives a damn?
Hopefully that's not the story.
That's the whole point, is they did that with The Dark Knight. It wasn't called Batman, and it worked, and it became that most successful movie. Why can't they do it again? Like, I don't understand why they have to use that title.
Yes, in this one, The Dark Knight Rises.
Didn't he already begin, though?
He began.
And does that not involve and then rising?
He was The Dark Knight, and then he rises.
Take the blinders off, Corey. I'm telling
Who
you.
Who cares?
Man.
It's just a title. Who cares? Who cares?
The title matters.
It's not going to matter to the eventual quality of the movie. You're not going to go see The Dark Knight Rises and be like, 3.5 stars. It would have gotten that extra half star if it weren't called The Dark Knight Rises.
I don't know.
Do you think that way?
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I think of...
Because I don't think that way.
I think of everything. It's one whole thing. And if it has a crappy title, then I'm not going to forget that all of a sudden. I'm going to remember it.
Just acknowledge that, oh, wow, I didn't really like that title. 4 stars anyway. That movie's awesome.
But it's part of the experience.
Exactly.
Okay.
I agree. I wouldn't affect its score, but it is part of the experience. And when you leave the theater, man, I wish it had been called something else.
Well, let's wait until we see the movie, because it's possible that The Dark Knight Rises could, in fact, be a title that is appropriate.
Well,
I don't
know.
Just playing devil's advocate here.
But see, you can make that argument for any movie, literally. Well, you know,
Killing Them Softly.
Well, you know,
he does that.
He was, he was the Hudsucker proxy. And look,
those characters are lawless.
Right, exactly. You can say that about any movie. So the fact that he might rise in this movie, okay, he rises.
He might stand up from a chair.
Yeah, exactly. So what? That doesn't mean it's not a bad title, and I think that it is in this case. I'm sorry.
I would actually be more okay with it if The Dark Knight had any other word after it, so that it wasn't just pulling that movie's title and then adding an additional word. If it was changing a word, if it was like The Dark Knight Falls or something, and that's a dumb name too, but you get my point that you're just changing a word instead of just taking the whole title and throwing another word on the end of it.
Do you know what I did the day that they announced this title? When we found out finally the third Batman movie is going to be called The Dark Knight Rises. I read that. I thought, okay, well, not great. And then I went about my life expecting it to be amazing.
Well, we're talking about this on a movie podcast.
I know. This is a program about splitting hairs. I understand
that. Batman Begins is not a great title either.
No,
it's not. But great movie. I like it a lot. Yeah.
It's an okay movie.
Batman Forever.
I prefer that to Batman Begins, honestly. But I agree.
The name or the movie?
Both, actually.
Yeah.
What the hell?
Both.
I'm about to flip this desk over. Are you kidding me?
I'm not kidding.
What part of that movie? Okay, another time.
When they come, and they will, they'll come for you.
I have an army.
We have a Hulk.
The Marvel blockbuster The Avengers has already cleared $1.3 billion worldwide and is sitting pretty with a $529 million domestic gross. That puts it, I think, within spitting distance of overpassing The Dark Knight, if it hasn't already. I don't remember what that topped out at. But there's one thing that's clear. People keep coming back for more, even still in its fourth or fifth week of release now. But Reuters reporters Lucas Shaw and Brent Langs article on Yahoo News suggests that the Disney Marvel behemoth, that its dominance isn't making for a level playing field, causing poor performances from films released in subsequent weeks, like Battleship, which we already talked about, but also The Dictator and Dark Shadows, which have not made anywhere close to as much money as their studios expected them to. Now, Ben, is The Avengers really to blame for those movies tanking?
Yes, it is, because audiences, moviegoers, have a better choice the weekends those other movies are released, and it just so happens to be a really good movie that people would rather see than this dreck that Hollywood is releasing right now. And I haven't seen a lot of that, but that's because I have chosen not to see them because I don't like what they're pushing at me this summer. I think this has been one of the weakest Mays that I can remember, to be honest with you, especially in terms of films that I actively want to see during the summer movie season. And Avengers has been the only one that I want to see. So if I'm the Avengers and I'm Marvel and I'm Disney, my response to this is, I'm sorry, we're a good movie and we're worth it. Make better movies, other movie studios, and then maybe you'll make money.
Well, you're right, but I don't think that's because the Avengers exists. You're right that people like the Avengers. You're right that these other movies, and I'll talk about it later, are not good. And it falls upon the studios to produce better, more appealing content. But the fact of the matter is, nobody wanted to see Battleship, The Dictator, or Dark Shadows anyway. They could have been good, but the fact that they weren't is almost irrelevant. The fact is that they just weren't appealing. Now, we've seen countless examples every summer of a movie opening huge one weekend. Not the Avengers huge, granted, but opening huge. And then the next weekend, another movie also opening huge. Two highly anticipated movies opening almost back-to-back still somehow make money. Look at May 2007. Now, you can debate the merits of these movies, but that month saw the release of Spider-Man 3, the third Pirates of the Caribbean movie, and the third Shrek movie, and they all made a ton of money within 4 weeks of one another. The fact is, the Avengers being good and these movies being bad is irrelevant. The fact is that people wanted to see the Avengers, and they didn't want to see these other movies because they just weren't interested in them. These concepts were not interesting.
That's my point. I'm saying that you can blame the Avengers just because it happens to be worth all of the money that it's making, and people love it as much as they do, and these studios are releasing uninteresting titles. Release more interesting titles and films that people want to see, and they won't spend all their money and their time at the Avengers week after week because they'll have better and more options.
The article, though, takes the position that it interviews these befuddled studio heads, like the Universal people, who are like, well, I've got to think that if the Avengers weren't doing such good business, that we would have made more money, as if people are choosing in the third week of its release between seeing the Avengers for a third time or seeing Battleship for the first time. I take issue with that positioning, the idea that, oh, well, you know, there's only so many movies that people are going to go see, and if they're just going to go see the Avengers again because they really like it and it's good, that doesn't leave anything for our terrible Battleship movie.
If your movie wasn't terrible, then they would go see it, though.
Well, if they were interested in it, they would.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
It doesn't matter that it's terrible. It matters that it wasn't marketed well. It matters that it's based on a board game. All of those things matter. It matters that it's a joke to audiences and it doesn't have any stars in it.
Well, obviously, the Pirates movie that you said that went up against Spider-Man 3, it made money. It was going to because it was based on an existing, very successful and profitable Disney property. But again, you're talking about a series of films that were based on a theme park ride,
right?
Too. So they were presented that same challenge. So
but
why
the first
anybody,
movie was good.
Right, the first movie was good, but I'm saying it had the same challenge Battleship did. You're fighting an uphill battle in terms of you're taking a concept that people only know through either a board game or a theme park ride or a toy line, and you're having to flesh out an interesting and very entertaining story. And in the case of Pirates, they were successful with that. In the case of Battleship, which I think could have succeeded, they did not. Now, I think a really strong parallel to why movies can succeed in the face of the success of a behemoth blockbuster movie, I go back to summer 2008 when The Dark Knight came out, when you have an all-timer. We've already talked about the fact that it broke records. It's the second highest grossing film of all time. The Avengers might take over here in the next few weeks. But what was released the same weekend as The Dark Knight?
Mamma Mia.
Mamma
and
Mia.
And it made a lot of money.
Mamma Mia released on the same day as The Dark Knight. That was July 18th, 2008. That film did a solid $144 million domestic gross, and it had minimal week-to-week drop-offs, and obviously it's good counter-programming. It's going after a different audience overall, but so is Dark Shadows. In a way, that's based on a soap opera. Who knows what Dark Shadows was before this Johnny Depp movie was released? Women who grew up when the show was aired and
well, that's
knew
what
who
Warner
Barnabas
Brothers
Collins
hoped.
Exactly, but I'm saying you can have good counter-programming that can be successful, again, when a film like The Avengers or The Dark Knight is released. Okay, talk about people who might want to go see The Dark Knight again in its third week or another movie. Well, Step Brothers was released in its third week, and Step Brothers did a very respectable $30 million opening and ended up grossing $100 million domestically, even with this monster, The Dark Knight, that was released. So you have good movies, more marketable movies that are being, again, counter-programmed to something like The Dark Knight and even reach out to similar audiences in some cases, and they succeed because they're good.
Well, Mamma Mia is not good.
Well,
the problem is they're, and this is a larger problem with Hollywood, but they need to stop going after these built-in audiences with these intellectual properties and just start making good movies.
Well, there aren't built-in audiences. Just because something is a brand doesn't mean it
has
a...
But they think there is.
I know. That's why Battleship exists.
Exactly.
And it's foolish. The fact that they think they'll attract everybody who's played the Battleship game with this alien invasion movie starring a guy from Friday Night Lights and Rihanna.
Yeah,
Seems a little wrongheaded to me, maybe.
And the movie industry isn't the only industry that does it. It's just the one that spends so much money doing
it. Right, you're right.
And it becomes a problem that way.
I mean, it boils down to marketing and to concepts that people are interested in. I mean, Mamma Mia, you're right, was an example of successful counter-programming. That movie's not good, but I don't think it's good. A lot of people really like it.
It ain't for you.
It's not, but it was pretty awful. In a lot of ways.
You know, I'll buy one thing, that there are people who only go see maybe a movie every 3 months or so, maybe every other month. And those people probably saw Avengers and wouldn't go see one of these other movies. But if the Avengers hadn't come out, how much did the Avengers make? Either of you have a ballpark figure?
200.
All right, so if the Avengers hadn't come out and made $200 million, that $200 million would not have been then distributed amongst the rest of films. However, maybe like $10 million would have.
Maybe in the second or third weekend.
Sure. I think that they may have gotten a little bit of extra bump from the Avengers not being out, but not anything that would have made it a successful movie.
Well, you think back to a weekend in summer 2004, the end of May, where Shrek 2 in its second week and The Day After Tomorrow in its debut weekend both made over $60 million or something like that. That has never been replicated, but those were two movies that people wanted to see. So it's possible for movies to share the same marketplace and do very well, as long as they're movies that people actually care about and want to see. These weren't movies that people cared about and wanted to see. And reading this article with these studio heads saying, oh, well, you know, we put out a good product, people just, we're going to see The Avengers, that's deflecting blame in a really stupid way.
It's denial is what it is.
Yeah.
We're taking a break, finally. When we come back, my brother Graham is going to tell us about seeing Wes Anderson's new film, Moonrise Kingdom, in Paris, France. You can start hating him right about now. Stick around.
What kind of bird are you?
I'm a sparrow. She's a dove.
No, I said, what kind of bird are you?
We are back, and giving us an early look at Wes Anderson's newest film, Moonrise Kingdom, is my brother Graham Flanagan, who recently saw the film during a vacation to Paris, France.
This is Graham Flanagan reporting for Film Nerds and Aspect Radio. Last week, while on vacation in Paris, on an especially rainy afternoon, my girlfriend and I took the opportunity to check out Wes Anderson's newest offering, Moonrise Kingdom, which was playing at a cinema in the neighborhood known as Saint-Germain. By now, most of you are already familiar with the basic plot, which is about a couple of 12-year-olds who fall in love and decide to run away together on an impromptu camping trip in the wilderness off of the islands of New England. Their actions creating a frenzied rescue attempt spearheaded by a scoutmaster played by Edward Norton and a local police officer played by Bruce Willis. While Moonrise Kingdom doesn't jump to the top of my list of Wes Anderson favorites, I definitely enjoyed it a great deal and find it a welcome addition to the filmmaker's canon, which is growing at a refreshingly steady pace. Anderson's signature combination of symmetrical cinematography, meticulous production and costume design, and of course, a diverse soundtrack filled with songs you've never heard of, but now make you feel slightly cooler after having heard them, all come together to create a work that is undeniably pure Wes Anderson. While children have often played prominent roles in Anderson's previous movies like Royal Tenenbaums and Rushmore, his decision to make kids the heroes of Moonrise Kingdom serves as a welcome and original turn for the director, whose last couple of live-action works have drifted, thematically speaking, into a somewhat dark realm of adult situations that obscure the humorous whimsy for which Anderson is primarily known. But be forewarned, there's plenty of that darkness on hand in Moonrise Kingdom, which deals with many of the serious themes that have become staples of the Anderson universe, such as death, depression, adultery, abandonment, and a variety of psychological disorders. However dark it may get at times, Moonrise Kingdom remains primarily an adventure film peppered by a delightful illustration of young love through the eyes of those experiencing it. I definitely recommend Moonrise Kingdom, but see it in America if you can. Our screening featured French subtitles, which were distracting at times, namely during one of the best shots of the movie when they covered up a line of canoes being paddled across a lake. You'll know the shot I'm talking about. For Aspect Radio, this is Graham Flanagan in New York City.
Thanks a lot, Graham. We honestly can't decide if we're more jealous about going to Paris or you seeing a Wes Anderson movie before we did. We'll take another break and come back with our thoughts on new trailers for Paul Thomas Anderson, James Bond, and Ron Burgundy's new movies. Stay with us.
Oh, it's jean creaming time.
It's cream in your jeans.
No, Brick, you need to say something different. Something on your own.
You're gonna cream.
Independent of anything the three of us say, the first thought that pops into your mind, you just say it.
This is gonna make you cream.
Ain't this an old-fashioned shot to the nutsack?
We're back on Aspect Radio with Ben Flanagan and our producer, Andrew Richardson. I'm Corey Kraft. Ben, in recent weeks, we've been spoiled with new trailers, including Paul Thomas Anderson's new film, The Master, Baz Luhrmann's take on The Great Gatsby, the Anchorman sequel, Sam Mendes' James Bond film, Skyfall, and the King's Speech director Tom Hooper's Les Miserables. Which of these new trailers impressed you the most?
Is this a joke?
Uh-oh.
What about this last episode on the way home?
What episode, sir?
The episode you had on the way home here.
I don't remember an episode.
You have no memory of what happened?
We were celebrating. We were drinking and dancing, but I don't remember an episode. Was there a fight? What happened?
I mean, I know that these are all fine choices that we have here.
I feel like you set me up.
Well, I'm just saying, have I not expressed that one of these people are my favorite directors of all time and whom I think is the best contemporary filmmaker that we have?
Adam McKay.
Well, now we have an argument to make.
Yeah.
But no, it's The Master, and it's easy.
It's a pretty evocative, incredible little teaser, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And he did it with There Will Be Blood, where without even, I don't think, notifying the studio, he just sort of whipped up a little teaser and threw it on YouTube without telling anybody.
Yeah,
and you saw a little bit more of that and what that movie would be than you do here with The Master. Like you said, evocative, very mysterious. We don't really know much about it at all, other than it involves, number one, Joaquin Phoenix is back and he's acting again, and it looks like he's going for it.
Yeah,
he plays this Navy man who obviously is having these emotional, psychological, and possibly physical problems, and he's been doing things he's not really aware of. He's being interrogated by a superior officer, and we get glimpses of what he's been involved with while being in the Navy. I'm not going to go at length to describe what all we see in this trailer, which is only, what, a minute and a half,
yeah,
minute and 40 seconds? I watched it about 30 times, literally.
Hey, it's a glimpse at a new Paul Thomas Anderson movie. What else do you need?
What's so interesting about this trailer is I think it continues to let us in on Anderson's evolution as a filmmaker and the evolution of his style that he is certainly making his own. I love Boogie Nights. It's still my favorite Paul Thomas Anderson movie, and it definitely might be after The Master. And I don't know if The Master is going to be good, and it might be my least favorite Paul Thomas Anderson movie. But there are so many people, our friend Ben Stark included, who would say that Paul Thomas Anderson is simply just ripping off Scorsese and Altman and some other filmmakers in terms of style with those movies, although those movies are completely his and his alone. I'll go to the grave arguing that. But I think that with Punch Drunk Love and There Will Be Blood and now this glimpse that we've gotten of The Master, I just see something new.
I see something way different that I'm not getting from any other filmmaker out there in terms of how the films are shot, how the films are scored. In this case, again, I believe with Johnny Greenwood, with whom he worked on There Will Be Blood. It's just something original, and that's why I think he is so good and remains my number one contemporary guy. So yeah, the master out of all these, Runaway number one.
Yeah, well, I agree. What did you think of, well, the Great Gatsby trailer was sort of controversial upon its release. How do you feel about that?
You know, I thought that, like, the Jay-Z music was a little jarring at first, but then you have to sit there and realize, wait, this is Baz Luhrmann,
right.
So it's going to be batty no matter what, and he's going to do whatever he wants, music-wise, style-wise. I think that it definitely has the glitz of Fitzgerald's story that it needs, but I just hope that we don't get something that's over-stylized and chooses to ignore the substance of Fitzgerald's novel. I've been wanting to see a good Great Gatsby movie for a long time, and I wasn't sure that I was going to get it with Baz Luhrmann necessarily, but I think that we're definitely going to get the Luhrmann take no matter what, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a lot more excited about the Luhrmann take on The Great Gatsby than any definitive film version of The Great Gatsby, but already from the trailer, which I love the look of, by the way, I think that we've got a better performance as Daisy from Carey Mulligan than the entirety of Mia Farrow's performance in the 70s film. That didn't take much. What about the Anchorman teaser?
It's great.
Yeah, it's just fun.
You know,
just the guys in the same room.
Anchorman was on TBS last week, I think, and I hadn't seen it in a while. And we've talked about our top 10 comedies from the past 10 years. It's my number one. It's one of my favorite all-time comedies. And I sat there and watched it. I just couldn't stop laughing. I was like hyperventilating. And these are things I've heard over and over for the past 7 years or so. And it just felt fresh again. So yeah, I mean, when I saw these guys each give their little line in this teaser, it was great. It's just good to see Will Ferrell doing this character that, to me, not revived his career.
Well, sort of launched it.
Yeah, it sort of launched it. It spun it in a direction that it needed to go.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the most original characters ever, and I can't wait for more.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's nothing substantive considering they haven't started filming the movie yet, but just seeing those actors back in character was pretty delightful.
Well, now I don't know how you feel, but we haven't talked about the James Bond movie, Skyfall, yet. And I think that there are some trepidations from a lot of even James Bond lovers about this, because based on Quantum of Solace, which was directed by a more dramatically leaning filmmaker like Mark Forster, we're coming back here with Sam Mendes as the follow-up director to that film, which wasn't very good.
Nah, Quantum of Solace was pretty lame.
But I have to say, Skyfall looks pretty awesome.
Yeah, it does. I don't know who's trepidatious about this after seeing that trailer, but man.
Well, I think before they were.
Well, maybe.
Because, I mean,
maybe.
You've got the maker of American Beauty and Jarhead making a James Bond movie, or Revolutionary Road, and that just didn't seem to go together. But now, having seen this trailer, it kind of makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Roger Deakins lensing, bring it. I'm all about it, you know. I probably won't be over the moon for it because I'm very seldom over the moon for any James Bond movie, but, you know, I'll see it. I'm pumped.
Okay, and how about Les Mis?
I think it looks cool, but I think that Anne Hathaway sounded pretty brutal.
Wow, I mean, you're talking about the centerpiece of this trailer here.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, she's a better actor than singer, right?
I guess.
She's got to be.
Well, if your only example of that, or your main example of that, is the job she did hosting the Academy Awards, then... Yeah.
I forgot she sang that little song.
Not looking good.
Well, I mean, I'm sure the movie will be fine. I mean, like I said, visually, it looks pretty terrific. It looks like Tom Hooper and his DP, Danny Cohen, who was nominated for an Oscar for The King's Speech and who helped craft some of those memorable visuals from that movie, they look like they're firing on all cylinders here. It looks pretty epic. It looks to have the scale that the story needs. I'm not sold on the singing, which is kind of important when you're talking about this.
Yeah, I like musicals about as much as I like child actors, to be honest with you.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I feel about the same way, which is why something like Rock of Ages looks like a nightmare to me.
Oh, I'm going to go see that.
This looks like less of a nightmare. I think the biggest concern we should have here is not Hathaway, but more because she can actually lend you some dramatic weight performance-wise. Mm. It's Amanda Seyfried.
Yeah.
What has she done lately to warrant any anticipation for a film that she's in?
Dear John. I'm just joking.
Was she in that? She was in that, right?
Can you?
No, I thought she was in the other one that was like that. That
I don't
came
know.
Out
she was in the one with Letters, Channing Tatum. Letters to Juliet? Is that
she,
the one?
Well, she was in that. Is she in Dear John?
I think so.
I think
I saw it.
I saw it too. I don't know.
I mean, that was a wife movie, but...
Yeah, my wife wouldn't be caught dead seeing that. Nor, I think, would she be caught dead seeing Les Mis, even though she probably will. But, you know, she's a singer, and she took great issue with Hathaway's performance. She compared it to Emmy Rossum in The Phantom of the Opera, who was her, like, all-time movie singer hate person.
Which one is that? The lead?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, yeah. I hope this doesn't end up like The Phantom of the Opera, which was glitzy with no substance, but that's the worst case scenario here. And you know, fingers crossed that Tom Hooper comes out as a more adept dramatist than
Joel Schumacher. Has there ever been like a really great, successful
Broadway adaptation?
Yeah. That's still a musical when
many
it hits.
Of them.
Hairspray was a hit.
West Side Story?
Yeah. You guys are pulling some pretty old ones.
Hairspray?
Well, Hairspray's not that old.
5 years old. Dreamgirls was really successful. Chicago won Best Picture.
Yeah.
It's a pretty
Do you guys
deal.
Like any of those?
I love Chicago. I love Dreamgirls. I really like Hairspray, too.
Okay.
I'm a musical guy. I don't know why you're
I like musicals, too, and that's why I ask, because I kind of like all of them.
Yeah.
And so I don't have any perspective on whether they're good or
I
not.
I mean, The Phantom of the Opera didn't do it for
like,
me.
I liked Rent.
Oh, I didn't like Rent.
So I like all of them, so it's very hard for me to have perspective.
Mm. The most I can get out of this is the fact that Tom Hooper's directing it. It's his follow-up to the great King's Speech, which to me, looking back, I mean, it still holds up as a great movie. So I would anticipate whatever he did next. Mm-hmm. But to me, this is not as ambitious as the King's Speech, and it's a little disappointing that he would latch on to such a familiar thing.
But he's already got another property. Best Director nomination in the bag, pretty
Maybe.
Much.
I'm telling you, man, Seyfried might do this movie in. And that kid from My Week with Marilyn, who does not belong
in this?
Yeah, who does not belong in this period at all. I mean, he looks like straight out of 2012, forced into this movie.
I think there are other things that are more, you know, of an issue than Amanda Seyfried. I don't know how, because I don't know the musical. I don't know what kind of role that character plays. But Russell Crowe having to sing one of those. Anne
he
Hathaway.
Sings, man.
I know he sings.
What about, what's his band?
You can, you know, but you can growl your way through a
Dog
rock
Tooth.
Song.
What is his band?
30-odd something of something.
Oh, I'm thinking of Keanu's band.
I don't know what his band is called, but there's a difference between singing Broadway-style music and then just grunting your way through a rock song that you wrote.
Well, yeah, look. Les Mis is a pretty classic musical.
Right.
Hugh Jackman looks like he's going for something here. It looks like a physical performance, yeah. And look, Hugh Jackman, you can never...
He can sing.
You can never... Well...
Tony winner, I think.
I'm not looking forward to the singing, to be honest with you, but it just looks like he might be doing some good work here. So there's some things to look forward to, but I can't promise I'm going to see this in the theater.
What?
Yeah.
You're going to have to, dude.
No.
How are we going to talk about Oscar stuff if... I mean, you didn't see Extremely Loud, Incredibly Close, and... Well, one thing that we have learned, I guess, from doing this podcast is that you hate music and children. So, looking forward to finding out what else joins that list.
Corey, one trailer we haven't seen, despite reports from Cannes of a 6-minute trailer that played during a Weinstein Company presentation, is Quentin Tarantino's Western Django Unchained. But Weinstein did release several official images from the film, featuring Jamie Foxx, Christoph Waltz, and Leonardo DiCaprio, all in full costume and makeup. So how do these photos influence your anticipation for it?
It's so high as to be unchanged at this point. Just bring it on. That's all I've got to say. I mean, the costumes look like they should.
I don't really know anything about this movie, but Leonardo DiCaprio and Jamie Foxx in a Quentin Tarantino movie gets me kind of excited. I mean, obviously,
in a period sort of Western movie set, it's about slavery right before the Civil War. Jamie Foxx.
That's a different time. That's a sort of, wouldn't expect that from Quentin Tarantino.
Jamie Foxx wreaks beautiful vengeance upon those white people who wronged him.
Okay.
I'm down.
You sound pretty excited.
Yeah. It's a Tarantino movie, man.
I think it looks incredible. I think that the costumes all look fantastic, and these guys like Christoph Waltz's beard and his costumes and Leo's mullet and goatee and cigarette holder that he's working with there, and like Colonel Sanders' getup that he has, it's all working for me. And Jamie Foxx's like really cool green jacket and whatnot. It's awesome, and I can't wait. It looks a little clean to me, though, and I know that this is a complaint that you're sort of seeing on the online boards out there, the fact that Jamie Foxx's like gun holster and belt looks like he bought it at like a Kmart toy section. Mm-hmm. It's so just like clean and like it's not disheveled at all. There's no wear and tear. And when you watch a Western, I mean, these folks are grizzled. They're not clean worlds. Look, this is a guy I do give the benefit of the doubt, unlike Ridley Scott, unfortunately. So I'm willing to wait it out and see why.
I would believe there could be even be like a reason in the fiction for why. Mm. It's so clean.
Or hopefully. It's just a, you know, stage set photo.
Also that.
I mean, you never know. Tony Stark makes you feel he's a cool exec with the heart of steel. As Iron Man, all jets ablaze, he's fight and slice with the culture race. Amazing armor. Speaking of set photos, new set photos, these probably not official, judging by the quality of them, from Marvel's Iron Man 3, which just started shooting, show us the character Iron Patriot will appear in Shane Black's sequel. Early reports suggest that there will be multiple villains, including whoever is wearing this suit of armor. I think it appears to be James Badge Dale, who was cast, I forget who the character is, but obviously it's Iron Patriot, because he's wearing the Iron Patriot suit. So Ben, are you okay with Tony Stark taking on another bad guy wearing a weaponized suit in this one?
I don't think so. I mean, I'm okay with seeing Iron Man do anything, because I love the character so much, and I love what Jon Favreau gave us in the first couple of movies, like action set piece wise, so I expect the same thing. And look, I mean, it doesn't really matter who he's fighting, but I think villain-wise, in these first couple of movies and in a lot of the Marvel movies, that's where they're lacking, especially in the Iron Man movies. I think that we've gotten good performances from the likes of Jeff Bridges and Sam Rockwell and Mickey Rourke, but I just don't think...
You can leave him off the
list. Well, I just don't think that they've really amounted to anything, and I've not left the theater either time remembering much about the villains.
Well, I think the rumors surrounding this movie are that Ben Kingsley is the big bad guy.
Right.
Who's playing the head of a terrorist cell who is, Marvel says, absolutely not the Mandarin, even though I'm hearing now he is the Mandarin, not the racist caricature version of the Mandarin from the comics, but a slightly more updated version of the Mandarin. And then also that Guy Pearce is playing a scientist with Rebecca Hall, who are somehow involved with nanotechnology via the extremist storyline from the comics. So how this will all come together remains to be seen. I would be surprised, well, not too surprised maybe, if the climax of this movie is Iron Man fighting another guy in a suit, particularly after the Avengers. If I were Marvel, I would be sort of reluctant to have anything but like a really incredible climax for this movie after the bar has been kind of set so high. But, you know, I don't know. We'll see. I mean, story-wise, this could be promising. I'm not really familiar with the extremist storyline other than what I've read about it. I think that was kind of not recent. But the Iron Patriot is recent. Iron Patriot is post-Marvel Civil War. And I think that in the comics, that was Norman Osborn.
It's the Green Goblin, right?
Yeah. So I don't know how they're going to do this.
It's probably going to be a combo. I mean, like they did with the Mickey Rourke character from the last movie.
Yeah, with another puppet master, I guess.
Yeah.
But hopefully somebody a little bit more fearsome than Sam Rockwell, who was fun in that movie, but not exactly intimidating villain material.
No, not at all. So yeah, it should be interesting. I mean, in this Iron Patriot, isn't it sort of like a cross between Iron Man and Captain America, too,
well,
in terms
it was
of
like,
how he's designed?
My understanding is, that it is, and maybe that they'll be able to tie that into the Avengers storyline, the film storyline in some way. But in the comics, after the Marvel Civil War, the government disbanded S.H.I.E.L.D. and created a new organization led by Norman Osborn, the Green Goblin, as Iron Patriot. I don't know the particulars of that. And I would doubt that the movie will get that complicated with it. And obviously Norman Osborn won't be the character, but we'll see how it plays out, and I'm down for whatever the cinematic universe brings us.
¿Listos?
Yeah, you realize this means an angry letter to the Times.
¡Apuntar!
Well, we mentioned before that we've seen the trailer for Skyfall, the new James Bond movie directed by Sam Mendes. This is our third go-around with Daniel Craig as 007, and there's no good reason things should change when his first two films together cleared $1 billion worldwide. But we also thought that about Sony's Spider-Man movies, which got a reboot. Corey, are you satisfied with the brooding and less humorous Craig as Bond? And who should play the spy next?
Well, I am satisfied with Daniel Craig as James Bond. I wish that Quantum of Solace had been better than it was, but I think that Casino Royale was more of a physical, sort of brooding character in the mold of Jason Bourne, or even the previous release of Batman Begins sort of rebooted that character in a more solemn way, too. That being said, I mean, the Bond job after Craig is done is kind of Michael Fassbender's to turn down, right?
Yeah, I would think so. I would think Fassbender, and I think he would be my go-to choice. But a couple of names, pretty well-known names at this point, these up-and-coming British actors whom I think could slide into the role and lend it more of a refined touch that we haven't really seen with Craig in the role. And look, he brings it as much as anybody can, action-wise and physically, as this cold-blooded killer version of James Bond. But I think, you know, a couple of guys who could bring, again, that sort of suave, humorous, refined, those qualities to the James Bond franchise: Benedict Cumberbatch.
That'd be good.
And Tom Hiddleston.
Yeah, that'd be awesome too.
Why not those guys?
That might as well.
Yeah, I mean, I know that these guys are kind of scrawny, but so was Sean Connery.
So was Tom Hardy before he put on the muscle mass necessary for Bronson and just never took it off.
Actors can put on weight.
Yeah.
So those would be my choices, my top three. And I think any one of them could probably have it if they wanted it.
I would be disappointed. I mean, I know it would be good for James Bond and the character, but I want to see Michael Fassbender do other things and not be tied down to that sort of franchise. It's cool that he's playing Magneto, but let that be his one thing and let him do interesting movies like Shame, like Prometheus, things like that in between so he can still stretch those acting chops. I don't want to see him wasted on tent poles.
Well, and two, people have said that Cumberbatch and Hiddleston, they might be a little too goofy looking or weird looking to pull off James Bond, but my response to that would be, doesn't Daniel Craig look kind of like a coked out heroin addict zombie anyway? I mean,
I don't think so.
He's kind of a strange looking guy when you boil it down. I mean, go back to like Road to Perdition and look at his character in that. He's just a scary looking
dude.
He's
got some craggy, sharp features. I'd agree.
Well, that's the direction they wanted to take. They wanted to have Bond as like this bulldog sort of like, you know, scrappy bruiser guy who would just like kill you and not make a wisecrack instead of making a wisecrack and then killing you.
Well, all I'm saying is he's a strange looking guy. So
I think like Hiddleston looked fine in War Horse and put some weight on him. His cheeks fill out and stuff. I think he'd be fine.
Maybe Benedict Cumberbatch is kind of short, though.
Not short. He looks pretty tall and slender.
Is he tall? I don't know.
I don't know. Whatever. Those are my choices.
Well, those aren't bad. I'd be okay with any of those guys except, you know, maybe not Fassbender because he's so good and everything that I don't want him to be locked down to James Bond.
I still think Johnny Depp was the way to go before they got Daniel Craig. He was my choice. Think about it.
Really? No. I don't want to.
Think about it. It would have worked.
Yeah. Well, we'll take one more break. And when we come back, I'm going to fill you in on the movies that have come out in the last couple weeks since we recorded the podcast on the Avengers. Bunch of big summer releases. I've probably let my hand slip a little bit as to what I think about them. But stick around just to make sure you're not wrong.
I'm an agent of Men in Black, but I'm from the future. We're partners. 25 years from now, you're going to recruit me. And 14 years after that, the guy you didn't let me kill today at Coney Island, he escapes from prison and jumps back in the past and unleashes a full-scale invasion of Earth. We had about 19 hours to catch him and kill him. So really, we need to go right now.
All right.
What is your real name? I am interested.
In place.
In place what?
In place, Miss Wishens.
That is a made-up name.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
What is your real name?
Max.
Max what?
Immum Occupant CU-120.
There is a number in the name?
Mm.
Welcome back. Corey, you've seen pretty much every major release in theaters since The Avengers, when we last met here and had a show. That's Battleship, Men in Black 3, The Dictator, and Dark Shadows. So for those of us who skipped all of them, what did we miss out on?
Of those four, you didn't miss out on much. You know, I already sort of alluded earlier in the show as to my feelings about Battleship, The Dictator, and Dark Shadows. Battleship, of course, being a pretty wretched example of Hollywood excess. And The Dictator in Dark Shadows squandering the talents of some talented people. The Dictator in particular shows that Sacha Baron Cohen's shtick, such as it is, doesn't really work without the element of, I guess, normal people being punked or the audience not laughing at the offensive things that Sacha Baron Cohen is saying, but the reaction of normal people to the offensive things that Sacha Baron Cohen is saying. It's almost like with The Dictator, the audience is the people in Borat and Bruno who are being made fun of by laughing at these jokes. And it kind of leaves a weird, icky feeling when you're watching it. But worse than that, because I can handle being offended, I'm a grown adult, it's not funny. It should be funny, but it's not. It doesn't really earn, I guess, the unpolitical correctness. I mean, if you're the sort of person who laughs at something because inherently it's not politically correct, you're going to have a ball. But if you like funny jokes, there aren't that many in this movie, unfortunately. Dark Shadows, another example of Tim Burton being more concerned with production design instead of drama. I liked the first half of this a lot, and then when it actually has to have a plot, it goes downhill really fast. Again, getting talented people, Johnny Depp actually being fun and funny for the first half of the movie with a pretty great cast surrounding him
who then are just totally wasted when the plot gets extremely complicated and not interesting as the film goes on, culminating in a pretty awful third act. Wasted opportunity there, particularly since I was pretty into it for the first 45 minutes or so. And then Battleship, of course, just everything you think it is.
That's exactly what I was going to ask. Is it just like,
yeah,
from watching that trailer, exactly what you think it's going to
yeah,
be?
Yeah.
Okay, well, what I thought it was going to be was a big, dumb, loud action movie that had really cool action set pieces that seemed to be well conceived and designed and executed, but had obviously a pretty weak story, bad performances from non-actors. I mean, is that close? Do these action sequences have some merit?
I don't think so.
Hmm.
I think they're pretty boring. I think it's like the worst stuff from Transformers. I mean, it's no clearer or more interesting than any of that stuff.
I wonder if some of that's just because we've had movies like Transformers.
Well, it could be, but also, I mean, there's no story. I mean, what story there is just doesn't make sense. And why? Why do it? You know, like we said earlier, why sit through something like this when you've got the Avengers, which has the spectacle and the story and the humor? This is just a product put out to use the option on a brand name. And there's nothing else to it. As for the fourth movie, Men in Black 3, this past weekend's release and the number one movie in the country right now, this seems to be getting a lot of positive notices. I didn't care for it at all. I really did not enjoy this movie. Have you seen it, Andrew?
No, I plan on seeing it this weekend. I have a sort of soft spot for Men in Black.
Yeah, I do too. Well, I do for the first movie. I think the first movie is probably as close to replicating the sort of quirky horror, comedy, sci-fi elements of Ghostbusters that Hollywood has ever come to. And of course, having charismatic stars like Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones, and I think Tommy Lee Jones is charismatic in his own way, you know, that helps, but everybody seems so bored in Men in Black 3, particularly Tommy Lee Jones, who's not in it very much, by the way, as you'd expect, but even Will Smith, who usually puts forth an effort, doesn't seem as engaged by the material here. Now, a lot of people who like this movie are singling out the fact that the bulk of the story takes place in the 1960s with a younger version of Agent K, played by Josh Brolin, who does a very impressive Tommy Lee Jones mimicry, but that's a parlor trick. That's not a performance. You know what I mean? You can't base a character on the fact that he kind of eerily sounds like this other guy. It didn't work for me.
I saw him in a television interview, and he was just kind of doing the Tommy Lee Jones impression. It's very good, and it's very...
Yeah.
He's able to pull it out instantly.
Yeah.
But like you said, I can see that getting old after about 10 minutes... Well, 15 minutes of it.
When there's nothing interesting happened, you have this weak villain played by Jemaine Clement, who I love in Flight of the Conchords. He's mm-hmm. awesome, but he gets nothing to do. You have subplots that are introduced and dropped unceremoniously. You have characters that add nothing, you know, including great performers like Will Arnett and Bill Hader, who pop up in small roles who do nothing, unfortunately. Emma Thompson, too. And then, you know, it culminates in this admittedly pretty well-conceived climax. And a lot of people have mentioned the emotional tug that the end of the movie has on them. Well, one, if you think about it, you can probably figure out what that is. And two, it feels so forced as to just bother me instead of provoking any sort of emotion. It's just not earned. It's not earned. It's set up without regard to logic and the fact that, I mean, it's a pretty huge retcon of the whole series anyway. So that's a problem. The thing that irritates me most about Men in Black 3 is that it made me irritated by Michael Stuhlbarg, who I love as an actor. We've talked about him and his performances in A Serious Man and Hugo. And the fact that he gets kind of an annoying character here and is made to do kind of annoying things, really, I just resent that so much because I think Michael Stuhlbarg is great. Ugh. Yeah.
Well, let's move on to DVD. Is there anything we should be clued in on?
Yeah, we need to talk about Kevin. You and I were talking about this during a break, but that's Lynn Ramsey's new film featuring a dynamic, just towering Tilda Swinton performance. One of the better performances of 2011. Sort of an offbeat, untraditional little horror movie, I guess you could call it, because it certainly is horrific, but certainly not a horror movie in the sense the way that term is usually used.
It's a black comedy.
You think it's a black comedy?
Yeah,
I think it's got elements of black comedy.
Oh, I think it's very funny.
There are funny moments. I think a lot of it, though, is pretty uncomfortable.
Well, it is, but I don't think that this is one of those movies that you would call like a one-timer or something that's unwatchable.
No, I think it's very watchable.
Yeah, I don't think it, you know, I don't think of it the same way I would something like Elephant, something that you kind of labor through but can truly appreciate aesthetically and narratively too.
Or in the case of me and Elephant, not.
Well, something like that movie.
Right.
But to me, this movie is an entertainment.
Yeah.
But it's something that could not play on any screen that didn't belong to an art house or an indie theater. People would make it 10 minutes into this movie.
Is very unusual in structure and style.
It's very unusual, you know, but it's very stylish too. I mean, there's so much of this movie that's silent, where you're just watching Tilda Swinton sort of live her life or struggle to live her miserable existence.
Yeah.
And again, I said that, you know, this movie's funny, and you wouldn't think when you read the description of it or the log line or how we're describing it now, but it is. It's very funny. It has good performances, particularly Tilda Swinton, who got snubbed from the Academy Awards last year. And look, nobody saw the movie, so fair enough, but not many more people saw My Week with Marilyn, and I would have been perfectly fine with her taking Michelle Williams' nomination.
Did you see My Week with Marilyn?
Oh, yeah, yeah, I did.
And you didn't care for it, I guess.
I thought it was pretty overrated. The performance, anyway. The movie, I know, wasn't really that well-regarded, but the performance, a little overrated.
Like the movie, love the performance. What can I say? Also on DVD this week, speaking of movies that nobody saw, Ralph Fiennes' directorial debut, Coriolanus, an adaptation of William Shakespeare's play. Fiennes also stars with Brian Cox, Gerard Butler, Jessica Chastain, and Vanessa Redgrave supporting him. Great interpretation of a text that I was not familiar with, but it's very compelling, very interesting. Though, of course, contemporizing Shakespeare is not exactly a novel idea. He does it in a way that is really stylish and interesting, particularly from a first-time director. And he surrounds himself, because he is giving a very good performance as well, but he surrounds himself with supporting actors who are also giving very good performances, including, well, especially Vanessa Redgrave as Coriolanus' mother. It's really interesting, particularly if you like Shakespeare, and I recommend it highly. And then, of course, your movie that you didn't like, or that you liked a lot more than I did, Michael Dowse's comedy Goon, is on DVD this week. You can talk about that if you'd like. I don't really have that much to say.
Yeah, it's still my favorite movie of the year so far in this very young year, and I'm sure it's going to get supplanted because, as we've noted before on the show, there's a lot left to be seen by some of our favorite filmmakers. So, well, I don't expect this movie to be my favorite of 2012 when all is said and done, but the first time I saw it, I loved it. I enjoyed it. I mean, it was just so funny to me. I couldn't wait to spend the rest of the movie with those characters. I think Sean William Scott gives a nice, very sweet performance, and it just has great R-rated gags and is a solid, well-shot sports movie, a kind that we don't really see very often these days. So yeah, this gets my highest recommendation if you love just comedies and sports movies in general. So yeah, cool. Check out Goon.
Why are you being gay?
I think you're fucking being pretty gay.
It's not gay.
Not if you're brothers. If you're brothers, it's gay with a fucking dash of something else.
Starting this week, nationwide in theaters and in Tuscaloosa at the Cobb Hollywood 16, Snow White and the Huntsman with Charlize Theron, Kristen Stewart, and Chris Hemsworth. And For Greater Glory with Andy Garcia. I've seen TV spots for this suddenly pop up, but this is coming to Tuscaloosa.
Yeah.
Do you know much about this?
No, nothing. Nothing at all.
I know that desperate housewife girl is in it.
Eva Longoria?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think Peter O'Toole is in it. Well, check us out at aspectradio.net. You can email any of your feedback to feedback@aspectradio.net. Find us at twitter.com/aspectradio or facebook.com/aspectradio. And check us out on al.com and tusk205.com.
Find us on iTunes with a quick search or click the link on our blog. Read Corey's DVD column in Tusk Magazine every Friday in the Tuscaloosa News or on tusk205.com. Follow his Tusk musings on Twitter at CoreyTuskMovies. Be sure to visit our friend Matt Scalici's website, filmnerds.com, where you'll find some awesome blog posts and podcasts. And it's time now for our parting shots from our friends at filmnerds.com. We start with Matt Scalici.
Star Wars Episode 7, Indiana Jones 5, Muppet Schindler's List. These are just a few ideas that sound a lot better to me than a fourth Godfather film made without the participation of Francis Ford Coppola. Recently, the family of Mario Puzo, who was the original author of the book the Godfather films were based on, have decided that they're going to try to release a novel based on some unfinished material by Puzo that will take the Godfather story back before the events of the first film. So it's a Godfather prequel, essentially. And already we're hearing interest in possibly getting that novel made into a film. And what we haven't heard yet is Francis Ford Coppola's name brought up in any of this. Now, I'll be the first one to tell you, Francis Ford Coppola is not the guy he used to be. And frankly, having him involved in the film may not even change my mind about this project. But There's no questioning that the Godfather trilogy is what it is because of Francis Ford Coppola's work and not because of an author who wrote a fairly tawdry novel about gangsters. So should this film continue to head down the road to production, I may have to put myself on blackout just to prevent any further anger from welling up inside me about this project. Michael Corleone is dead, and so should the Godfather series be.
This is Craig in Nashville, and I've got some thoughts on The Avengers, the film that is spanking everybody at the box office. It's a film that is swollen with visual effects, but the one visual effect that I found persistent was the perpetual provocative placement of one Scarlett Johansson, aka the Black Widow. While trying to focus on the story, I often found my view obstructed by the backside of the Black Widow, who was standing just off-center and right in front of the camera. The film constantly attempted to redirect my attentions to the ScarJo's rump, so that begs the question of what the true focal point of the scene is, the story or the booty. There were scenes that consisted mainly of the Black Widow delivering dialogue, her skin-tight black suit zipped down the front just enough to give her some breathing room. But was the filmmaker's true intention to take our breath away? In one scene, the Black Widow battles a raging Hulk, but gets pinned under a thick beam and lands face down on her stomach. Appropriately, she makes sure to posturize herself in a position not at all unlike the one Catherine Zeta-Jones used to slide under the laser grid in Entrapment. Unfortunately, instead of being affected by the suspense of the scene, my alarm was triggered. The Avengers employs a product placement for the ScarJo's goods. It takes every opportunity to slide a taut and perky body between the audience and the scene. The problem is that these protrusions were a tad too prominent, and I wonder if they had been more subtle with the ScarJo, would it have benefited the film? Or would the Woody Allens, the cell phone hackers, and the men who were in theirs of the world be complaining that there wasn't enough of the ScarJo to feast on?
Hey guys, it's Ben Stark with Wonder Mill Films up here in Huntsville. I am currently trying to come up with some good content to share with the backers of our Kickstarter campaign that we're running to help raise money for getting our films onto Netflix, Hulu, and iTunes. And I thought something neat to do might be to revise my top 10 to 25 favorite movies of all time and share that with those folks. And in the process of doing so, I discovered that I have several movies from the same directors popping up several times on my list, and I realize I have a guilt about that. I'm wondering if that's something that other movie nerds have too, that let's say Steven Spielberg shows up on my favorite 10 movies list three times, if I'm honest with myself. The same goes for the Coen brothers. Hitchcock shows up twice. Kurosawa in my top 25 shows up twice. And I feel guilty just because I feel like I should have a more broad range, and I feel I'm not sure where the guilt comes from. If I would assume that other movie nerds would call me shallow or unrefined, probably Matt Scalise would call me too populist. So Raiders of the Lost Ark, Jaws, Jurassic Park, those are all on my list. Three Coen brothers movies, maybe four, would be Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, Miller's Crossing, The Big Lebowski, and probably No Country for Old Men. I have naturally other favorite movies that are on the list, like Pinocchio, the 70s version of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, The Life Aquatic, Shoot the Piano Player, The Palm Beach Stories, The Seahawks. So there is a kind of a wide smattering on there, but really the top of the list is really weighed down by the Coens and Spielberg and Hitchcock. So I just wondered if anybody else out there in the movie nerd world has this kind of anxiety. So I'd love to hear from you guys and see if you guys go through that too. If anybody would like more info on our Kickstarter campaign, you can find us on Twitter at Wonder Mill Films, or you can just go to www.thenocturnalthird.com and click on the link there. Thanks, guys.
Thanks as always to our producer, Andrew Richardson. And until next week, from Tuscaloosa, Alabama, I'm Ben Flanagan.
And I'm Corey Kraft. This is Aspect Radio. Thanks for listening. Don't stand a chance.